From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, new powers for Russia's FSB, the female imams of China, and dancing your way into marriage in Sudan. We've heard a lot about Russian spies lately. Now we're going to hear about how Moscow keeps tabs on its own citizens. Russian lawmakers are working on a bill that would expand the powers of the successor to the KGB, the Federal Security Service, or FSB. The new law would enable FSB agents to give official warnings to people suspected of planning a crime. Supporters say it's a way of dissuading potential offenders. Opposition leaders fear it's a new kind of intimidation. NPR's David Green reports from Moscow.
Alexander Artemyev wasn't surprised when police broke his arm.
It was a very dirty story, in fact, all the day.
This is sound from the day, May 31st in Moscow. Artemyev, who's 25 and writes for an online news site, was dragged away with other members of an opposition movement called Solidarity. This was Artemyev's fifth arrest, so he wasn't too bothered. What did trouble him was that police had gone to visit his mother a few months before. She refused to answer questions about his whereabouts or his friends.
No, she just said, go away, I will not tell you anything, even what I prepared for the dinner today.
Artemyev and other politically active Russians are worried the government may be seeking out new ways to intimidate the opposition. That includes a bill before lawmakers that would give the Federal Security Service, or the FSB, the right to do more than ask questions. They'll be able to issue an official warning to any citizen, quote, whose acts create the conditions for the committing of a crime.
И профилактика – это одно из средств, которое позволит сократить число людей, которые совершают преступления.
Supporters say the law is not aimed at political opponents, but at people on the verge of committing serious crimes. One example they offer is a person thinking of planting a bomb. He or she would get a warning that police are watching. Vladimir Vasilyev chairs the Security Committee in Russia's lower house of parliament, the Duma.
We're not collecting information to expose a person or to imprison him, but at an early stage, when there is no legally defined crime, we want to use preventative measures so a person can make a choice to stop.
The law passed several votes in parliament with support only from United Russia, the majority party led by Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. One person who voted against it is Gennady Gudkov, a former KGB agent. In Soviet times, he said, he supported laws like this. Taking preventative action against would-be criminals was a power the KGB often used to protect state secrets, Gudkov said. Let's say the KGB was suspicious because a person was storing military documents in his desk. Since he kept those documents in his drawer, Gudkov said, he received an official notice, and that had an effect. The KGB broke him of this habit. But this new law, Gudkov said, is written in such vague language, the government could easily use it, as he put it, as an instrument to pressure the opposition. And political analyst Masha Lipman from the Carnegie Moscow Center said this may be the intent. Prime Minister Putin and President Dmitry Medvedev, she said, have grown increasingly alarmed by anti-government rallies popping up over the past year. If people are organizing a protest, Lipman said, they might decide to stop if they receive a warning from the FSB that they're engaging in potentially illegal activity.
Apparently, the Kremlin is truly reluctant to reach a point where they would have to act like in Iran, facing a million of angry people in the street and having to use force for real and kill people. The Kremlin would much rather nip it in the bud.
Alexander Artemyev, the 25-year-old activist with the arm broken by police, said many of his friends are already too nervous to attend rallies. While he believes Russia is on an eventual path to political freedom, he says this new law will be one more hurdle to overcome along the way. David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
China has an estimated 21 million Muslims who've developed their own set of Islamic practices with distinctly Chinese characteristics. One unique development is the creation of independent female mosques with female imams. NPR's Louisa Lim sent this report.
It's 5:50 in the morning and the call to prayer echoes from a mosque in Kaifeng. This city in Henan province in central China has an Islamic enclave where Muslims have lived for more than 1,000 years. Men and women scurry through the dark alleys to the mosque. Here in Wangjia Hutong, the women go to their own mosque, where Yao Baoxia leads prayers. For 14 years, she's been a female imam, or an ahong as they're called here, in a word derived from Persian. She stands alongside the other women, not in front of them like a male imam would. But she says her role is the same as a male imam.
The status is the same. Men and women are equal here, maybe because we are a socialist country.
She decided to become an imam after she was laid off from her job as a factory worker. She studied for 4 years, first under a female imam, then with a male imam, sitting alongside men studying to become imams. She sees her main role as teaching Islam.
When people come to pray, sometimes they don't know how to recite the Quran. So female imams are teachers. We help people learn about Islam by studying one line at a time, and we lead the prayers.
I'm just being shown a couple of plaques high up on the wall of the Wangjia Hutong Women's Mosque. And these plaques date back to the 19th century, and they're used by scholars as proof of the fact that this is the oldest surviving women's mosque in China. Like other Chinese women's mosques, it began as a Quranic school for girls. These sprang up in the late 17th century here in central China. Then, more than 100 years ago, they morphed into women's mosques. 83-year-old Tang Guiying says when she was a child, the women's mosque was the only place a girl could go to get education.
I didn't go to school when I was small. We were all too poor. None of us girls studied. But I came here to play and study. The old imam was very, very old. She was 80-something, and she had bound feet.
She's sitting in the washroom as she talks. This is where women perform their ritual ablutions before prayers. This space and the female mosque itself doubles as a social center for these women, the heart of a community. In Kaifeng, there are 16 female mosques, a third the number of male mosques. Things that female imams can't do. They can't, for instance, lead funeral rituals or wash male corpses. At this funeral in Zhengzhou, mourners wail as they carry the coffin through the streets, but no female imams are participating. Here, most people do support the female mosques, but there's some resistance closer to China's borders with Pakistan and Afghanistan. Shui Jingjun from Henan Academy of Social Sciences has been studying women's mosques, a phenomenon she says is unique to China.
Historically, in northwestern China, there were no female mosques. There was resistance because they thought that building female mosques was against the rules of the religion. There are some voices who still say that. But in central China and most provinces, people think it's a good innovation for Islam.
The practice is spreading, with female mosques being established in the northwest in the past decade. Female imams in China have licenses to practice, issued by the Islamic Association of China, a state-controlled body that regulates Islamic practices in the country. This is part of the anomaly that is religion in China. The atheist Chinese authorities are endorsing a practice some Muslims may find unacceptable. But others believe that when it comes to female imams, China is leading the way. Here's Guo Baoguang, chairman of Kaifeng's Islamic Association.
Given the fast development of China's economy, and as its political status rises, I think Chinese Islam will become more important in the Islamic world. The developments Chinese Islam has made, like the role played by women, will be more accepted by Muslims elsewhere in the world.
In the female mosques, most of the faithful are elderly. Young women with families often don't have the time to worship, especially given the lengthy ablution rituals several times a day. Third-generation Imam Sun Chengying worries about the future.
I haven't had any students since 1996. Women don't want to be imams anymore because the salaries in the mosques are too low. No one is willing to do it.
Female imams sometimes earn as little as $40 a month, a third what they could earn in other jobs. Younger women need more to help support their families. And so it appears the future of female imams in China is threatened, not by the state, not by resistance from inside Islam, but by the forces of market economics. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
Coming up, dancing your way into marriage in Sudan.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. An occasional series on NPR is called The Hidden World of Girls, which is produced together with the Kitchen Sisters. This week, we visited a wedding in northern Sudan, where traditional customs often restrict women's lives. NPR's Gwen Tompkins is our guide.
What goes on between a man and a woman is often a mystery to the outside world. But here in northern Sudan, people pull back the curtain of mystique on one important occasion. After the marriage proposal, after the dowry has been paid and the wedding contract signed, there's a broad expectation that the bride will dance. That's why we're at this ceremonial hall in Khartoum. It's not what you think, but then again, maybe it is. The dance is one part Salome, one part Beyoncé, and the rest is, for lack of a better expression, shimmy shimmy Coco Pop, shimmy shimmy wow. This dancing bride is on stage with her brand new husband. She was wearing a long sequin shawl called a firka, but she took that off. Underneath, she was wrapped in the long traditional tulle that Sudanese women wear, but she took that off too. And now she's barefoot and rolling her hips in a little black dress, sleeveless, sequined, and short. Her knees are chubby. But here's the truth, people. The curvier you are, the better you look. Head and shoulders pulled back, with your bosom pointed high to the sky. Hands down low near your hips. Backfield in motion. It's like watching a tall ship pitch and dive in a restless sea. Steady as she goes. Only the groom and female relations are meant to see this dance. Muzdalifa Ahmed Alamin is a school teacher here. She says that brides used to dance topless in leather hula skirts called rahats, like her grandmother. It's not what you think, but then again, maybe it is.
Yes, she danced. My grandmother danced with rahat.
When she wore the rahat, did she wear any other clothes?
No.
Less than 100 years ago, nearly all young women here wore rahats. And El Amin's grandfather cut the string and threw her grandmother's rahat to the crowd, like a garter belt.
So when her husband took off the rahat, she was naked.
Yeah, this habit disappeared recently.
The throwing of the rahat symbolizes the end of maidenhood. Fatima Sir El-Khatim was 14 years old when her parents told her she was getting married. She's 60 now.
My family arranged that for me. I was too young. I just opened my eyes and saw him.
El Khatim married a school teacher, and she says she spent nearly 30 happy years with him, deeply in love. But El Khatim hated her wedding night. Her parents kept telling her to get up and do what Lady Gaga is now famous for saying, just dance.
In the past, there were no choice. Your father, your family tell you that, and you just have to say yes. You can't even say no.
Now I'm going to say some words that nobody ever wants to hear on their wedding night. Syphilis, gonorrhea, leprosy, breast cancer. How do these maladies relate to a nice little story about erotic dancing? Well, in the past, the bride danced to show her husband's family that she was healthy. Griselda El Tayeb came to Khartoum from England in 1950.
Her family are saying, look what you're getting. She's a virgin. She's not got leprosy. She's not got smallpox. So in a way, the same that white in European weddings symbolizes purity, whether it's true or not. Likewise, you could say that her semi-nudity was equal to the white.
El Tayeb is publishing a book on Sudanese traditions that her late husband wrote.
So as you know, Sudan is both African and Arab, but it's also neither African nor Arab. And as far as I know, this dance is unique to Sudan.
Nowadays, many women in Khartoum call bridal dancing undignified. Fatima El Khatim says she danced because she didn't know any better, but she told her daughters not to.
In the past, girls were young and they weren't educated, but now educated girls, they have a status in the society, they don't look good dancing like monkeys.
Muzdalifa El Amin says she'd hate to wind up on YouTube.
I like dancing very much. I didn't dance when I was a bride, but I dance for my husband, you see. I dance
alone.
Yeah, alone.
Shengota, a.k.a. Iman Ali, is one of the hottest dance instructors around. She says Sudan's educated elite like the glamour of dancing. Their weddings are getting more and more elaborate, like Cirque du Soleil.
Nowadays, it became as a fashion. Every bride wants to dance these days. So they say it is the most important part of wedding these days.
Yathrib Mohammed is a 28-year-old bride-to-be. She bakes herself daily in the sauna to make her skin so soft. She has her dress, her gold jewelry, and the weave she'll wear in the back of her hair. Mohammed is also practicing to dance more than 70 songs with 3 costume changes.
I chose to dance because it's a tradition, and in our family, basically, it's a must.
5 years ago, Umar Salah was on stage with his childhood sweetheart. Usually a man just stands there and snaps his fingers in rhythm with the songs. Then he throws a little money to the crowd and some candy and shares a sip of milk with his wife.
Basically, the groom is like an accessory, if you like, because everyone is there to watch the bride.
Salah says he couldn't wait to see his wife dance. But although his wife treasures the video of her performance, he says he rarely watches. Been there, done that, Salah says. It's not what you think. But then again, maybe it is. Gwen Tompkins, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.